The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. My name is Jeremiah Jacques, and I'll be guest hosting today for Mr. Stephen Flurry. And the program today is coming to you live from our studio here in Edmond, Oklahoma. It's a little bit quiet here on the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College today because the students and faculty are away at Robber's Cave. That's the part of rural southeast Oklahoma where the highly anticipated college campout happens at this time every year. My wife and I were there for the weekend and just had an excellent time enjoying conversation and some meals with the students and faculty there, doing some hiking in the very beautiful forests and singing songs around the campfire and all kinds of other activities. I think it marked my sixth year visiting Robber's Cave for the annual event, and I can't recall a year when the weather was as beautiful as it was this time. So hopefully it'll stay really nice for the duration of the camp out there. Well, I'd like to go ahead and launch into the main topic of today's program today. We'll be examining a question on today's episode, and it's a question that should be straightforward. It's only a very short two-word question, and it's one that should be simple to answer. But it's a question whose answer men cannot seem to agree on. The question is, what happened? What happened? This question is at the heart of the study of history. And it is what every one of the hundreds of thousands of history books and articles and historical documentaries that have ever been published say they are answering. These books and films and articles and other publications claim to be answering that question. You want to know what happened? Well, here's what happened. Read on. And that sounds good, but it's never quite that simple because of one big problem, and that is that when people write down history, they get it wrong. An old saying says there are three sides to every story. There's his side, your side, and what actually happened. And there's a lot of truth to that. The thing that actually happened is rarely exactly what any human party involved says happened. And that's especially true when the event was one that included conflict. Part of the reason why people who write down history get it wrong is because history's witnesses are infirmed by unreliable memories. Not one of us can perfectly recall all events, no matter how hard we might try. And history's scribes are also hobbled by deceptive emotions. So we've got faulty memories and deceptive emotions. So that means imbalance, bias, and a lack of objectivity are inevitable. Even when writers try really hard to keep those things out, they work their way in. So the result is that threads of inaccuracy are inadvertently woven into that tapestry of history. Thomas Bailey is a historian at Stanford, and he wrote this about the tendency of emotions to skew historical recording. He wrote, "Too many so-called historians are really hysterians. Their thinking is more visceral than cerebral." So when people try to answer that question, what happened, accidental discrepancies and problems are inevitable. But there's something else that's far more destructive and far more common than accidental misrepresentations, and that is intentional distortions, omissions, and revisions. Some may wonder why anyone would want to intentionally distort history And I think that that particular question is best answered by George Orwell. I've got a small excerpt here from his wildly influential dystopian novel, really the magnum opus of his life's work, 1984. In that book, Mr. Orwell said, "He who controls the past controls the future, and he who controls the present controls the past." That's a pretty chilling statement. He who controls the past controls the future, and he who controls the present controls the past. So it means really that authorities who oversee what people are taught about the past can manipulate that information, molding it in order to shape people's view of their place in the contemporary world. These authorities can really approach the past with a purpose. They can arrive at their conclusion first and then kind of work backwards to find supporting evidence for that conclusion. They can prune quotes here and there. They can cherry pick statistics. They can transplant facts out of their native context into foreign soil. And when they get tired of manhandling reputable sources, they can start to enlist unscrupulous sources instead. So if the authorities in a nation are able to use those kinds of tactics to shape the view of enough of their people, then they may be able to influence the path into the future that their nation takes. That's essentially what Orwell was saying. Authorities who wield history's pen have great power. Now, some of this might sound kind of abstract and theoretical at this point, but on today's episode, I would like to show how national governments get involved in answering the question, what happened, and how they teach history to their young people in ways that shape the populations. We'll talk about how history is taught in some countries in a way that is designed to fill the students with patriotism and nationalism, and how history is taught in other nations in just the opposite way, in a way that makes students really ashamed of their country. And then toward the end, we'll get into a little bit about what the ultimate authority and the ultimate history book says on this topic. Well, the most reliable way to see how the leadership in a nation wants to portray that nation's history is by looking at the history textbooks used in the nation's high school classes. I recently read a book by Dr. Dana Lindemann and Dr. Kyle Ward. The book is called History Lessons. And it's really fascinating because the authors collected textbooks from high school history classes all over the world. And in their book, they publish lots of excerpts from all of these various textbooks about all kinds of major events of history. And it's all translated into English, but besides that, it's exactly what the high school students read in their classes in these various countries all over the world. So the reader can choose an event like World War II, for example, and say, okay, how does Great Britain explain the history of World War II to its young people? And how does that compare to the way Germany teaches its students what happened? And how does Russia explain World War II history? And what about Japan and China and North Korea and the United States and so on? And then you can make the same comparisons with the Cold War or the global slave trade or the American Revolution or any other major chapter of world history. So I've thoroughly enjoyed reading this book and just being able to learn about the narrative that some governments teach their youth and to see how starkly different those narratives often are from each other, going from one country to another. And I'd like to get into some of these specific comparisons in just a moment, but first, a little bit about why studying textbooks instead of other history media really is the best way to understand how a government views its past and how it wants its people to view its past, even more importantly. The first reason is because history textbooks contain the most widely read historical account in any country. Second is that students encounter textbook accounts of history during their formative years. People are young when they read them, so they're more likely to have their minds and their worldview molded by what they read there. And the third reason is that, believe it or not, what textbooks teach students is a state-sanctioned version of history. I'd like to read a quote from Lindemann and Ward. It talks a little about this third point. It says, "In nearly all countries, the government takes some role in setting the standards for an acceptable cultural, political, and social history, i.e., what the authorities want the next generation to learn about its own national heritage, enfolding them, as it were, into a collective national identity." So textbook versions of history are far from objective. They contain a state-sanctioned version of history. They are typically written by national authors with a national audience in mind, and that ends up leading to a sort of insularity on any given historical topic for the students. Now, of course, the degree to which governments influence textbooks varies from country to country. Some nations tightly control everything about their history textbooks, from production right on through to distribution. These include countries such as Cuba, Nigeria, North Korea, most of the nations there in the Middle East and Central Asia. Whether a high school student in Nigeria lives on the beaches of Lagos or 800 miles away in Maiduguri, he will be taught history from exactly the same government-issued textbook. And that's the case in many of those nations that I mentioned there. In other countries, there's not quite as much control. Places like Japan and Germany, textbooks there are published by private companies, so it's not done directly by the government, but the government, either at the federal or regional level, requires these private publishing companies to conform to certain standards, and often those standards can be really rigorous ones. Then there are other nations that claim not to allow government control of textbooks. One of these is the United States. The U.S. claims to have a system for textbooks that is both totally market-driven and completely decentralized. But if you look just a little below the surface in these countries, you see that legislators still have an astounding amount of control over what is written in their history textbooks. And I'll get into more of those details specifically for the United States in the second half of the show, but the point for now is just that almost every nation really does control what its students are taught in history classes to some degree. I'd like to read a quote from Dr. Richard Minier, who specializes in Japanese history. And he said, "As a practicing historian, I encounter at every turn the power textbooks exercise over my students' minds. In Japan, it is the government that influences the content of textbooks. In the United States today, the problem is textbook publishers influenced by legislators. As far as the effect on students go, the difference is not great. Our students believe absolutely what they read in textbooks." So it's clear that national authorities can and do control what students are taught in history textbooks. So the next question is, how do they use this power? Well, the answer to that varies a great deal also from country to country. And first, let's take a look at some nations who use it to make their students more nationalistic and patriotic. I've got an article here from the BBC. This was published back in December of 2015. And this is about South Korea's history textbooks and a new law that the government there passed to do away with variation in the textbooks. Before this law was passed, South Korean schools were free to use any of 8 different textbooks that were produced by 8 different private publishing companies. But the government said these books were all too left-leaning, too politically correct, and too short of praise for South Korea and its history. So by government decree, all 8 of those textbooks are now history. And all South Korean students will be taught from a government-mandated version of history from a book with a fairly Orwellian title called The Correct Textbook of History. That's what all students in South Korea are now going to be taught from. The ruling unleashed a whole firestorm of criticism from academics and students and political opponents. One political group issued a statement saying, "Such a textbook allows the government to interfere with the interpretation and teaching of history. This infringes on the independence and political neutrality of education guaranteed by the South Korean Constitution." So why is South Korea doing this? It's because the conservative government sees the rising tide of nationalism and militarism happening across Asia. The government sees China especially rising up and just becoming a lot more aggressive. And the South Korean government sees the same thing happening in Russia and even Japan to a degree. The government sees all this, and it seems to be taking measures to ensure that South Koreans will be more patriotic and more nationalistic. The South Korean government wants the students to be proud of their country and even ready to fight for it, ready to die for it, if they're called upon to do so. So the government is getting rid of textbooks that are too politically correct and not praising enough of their country. And it's teaching students history now in a way that will make them more nationalistic and more proud of their nation. Now in Japan, the situation with textbooks and manipulating history is even more extreme. To understand why, we first have to know that in the lead-up to World War II and during World War II, Japan committed some heinous crimes against humanity. And up until the late 1990s, most of the textbooks in Japan did acknowledge a lot of those crimes and a lot of the really cruel and barbaric methods the Japanese Imperial Army used. The textbooks, up until the late 1990s, they made mention of the Japanese military forcing hundreds of thousands of women from Korea and China and other countries to become slaves for the Japanese soldiers. And the textbooks made some mention of the nightmarish medical experiments that the Japanese conducted on their prisoners of war. They mentioned the 1937 Nanjing Massacre, during which Japanese invaders butchered up to 300,000 Chinese civilians in just the most terrible ways you can imagine. The textbooks, up until the late 1990s, gave a fair amount of space to all of those terrible chapters in Japan's history. But then, in the early 2000s, the Japanese authorities got tired of discussing these things. They saw China starting to become more aggressive, and the Japanese rulers said, "We need to stop making Japanese students focus on all this history that just makes them ashamed of Japan. And we need to start teaching history in a way that makes them proud. We need to start teaching history in a way that will make students patriotic. Otherwise, if a war breaks out, none of them will want to fight for a country that they've been taught so many bad things about." So in the year 2001, and then again in 2006, Japan's Ministry of Education signed off on a textbook written by nationalists. This new textbook glossed over many of those atrocities that the Japanese committed before and during World War II. The new government-mandated textbook calls the Nanjing Massacre a, quote, incident instead of a massacre. And instead of telling the shocking number of Chinese civilians who were slain by really barbaric methods, it simply says, quote, many Chinese died. The new government-mandated textbook, when referring to Japan's military occupation of Asian nations, it always uses the word advancement instead of invasion. It makes no mention of those women who were made to be slaves for the soldiers. And the new book was designed to teach students that Japan was really not so much an aggressor as it was a liberator of Asian states from Western threats. So it really does. It was quite a stark change, the new textbook there in Japan. I've got a quote here from a Japanese journalist named Mariko Oi. She says that she only learned about her country's wartime history after she moved out of Japan and started studying abroad. She says, "I myself only got a full picture when I left Japan and went to school in Australia." And her experience is representative of what most Japanese students now learn about history. There's a lot more focus on ancient samurai history and things like that than there is on World War II. And when World War II is discussed, it's whitewashed in a way that really misrepresents Japan's role in it. A recent poll was cited in a thesis titled Japanese History That the Japanese Don't Know. And this poll showed that 26% of Japanese high school students don't even know that Japan annexed Korea in the years leading up to World War II. Can you imagine a German student not being taught that Germany invaded France in World War II? That's really similar to what's happening in the way Japan teaches some of its history. And because of Japan's lopsided and whitewashing approach to teaching World War II history, many among Japan's younger generations seem to view the war the way they would see a natural disaster, something like a tsunami. They see its causes as kind of abstract and irrelevant. They say, yes, it was unmistakably terrible, but it was a tragedy for which no one is really to blame. I'd like to play a clip here from an expert in this field that explains a little bit about this. This is Dr. Michael Chuchek. He's an adjunct professor at Waseda University there in Tokyo. And in this quote, the Abe that he mentions is Japan's prime minister, Mr. Shinzo Abe. Here's the clip.
What's grabbing me most right now is the transformation of the role of diplomats. Previously, diplomats were supposed to be diplomatic. They were supposed to make things smoother and easier. But now, under the Abe administration, we have a transformation of the actions of the nation's diplomats so that they're now enforcers of the Japanese view of the world. In the case of textbooks, these revisions of textbooks and the requests for revisions of textbooks of other countries, these are very invasive and very, very abrupt decisions. This is really not what diplomats are good at, but instead what we're seeing is the Japanese government is having its diplomats overseas go and ask publishers, ask authors, to change what they've written in their books, in textbooks in other countries, but it's become much more than reasonable. It's an ideological position, and it's a sense that, yes, if we can, this is really true. You know, if we get the kids early and get them taught about the right history, they'll be patriots. They'll be willing to die for their country.
Get to the children early, Dr. Chuchek says, and you can turn them into patriots. That's what the Japanese authorities are really trying to do. And the concerning thing is that for many Japanese policymakers, Japanese history and its textbooks are still not patriotic enough, even after these recent changes that happened in 2001 and 2006. In the December 2012 election, the Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP, called the current history textbooks, even after these changes, quote, ideologically prejudiced expressions based on self-torturing views of history. And the LDP pledged to restore more patriotic values in the textbooks. The Prime Minister, Mr. Abe, has long said that further changes in education are required in order to restore a strong sense of self in Japan. Last January, his administration successfully changed screening guidelines for textbooks to give them an even more patriotic and nationalistic tone. And now Mr. Abe has also set up a panel that's working to abolish what is called the Neighboring Country Clause. That's an ordinance instructing textbook authors to factor in the sentiments of neighboring countries in what they write. Now Mr. Abe is doing away with that clause. We don't care about what China or South Korea or anyone else thinks about what we write. We just need to write it in a way that makes Japanese students more proud, more patriotic. So Japan really seems eager to instill more patriotism in its young people, and it views history textbooks as the best way to accomplish this. The Japanese leadership hears the war drums beating in China and Russia and elsewhere, and the Japanese leaders know that students who are raised on a diet of guilt about their nation's past do not make successful soldiers. They also know that the United States is no longer a reliable ally to guarantee Japan's security. So they see the need to start to be ready to defend themselves as the U.S. ship continues to sink. So they're trying to teach their students to be patriotic about Japan so that they'll make good soldiers if and when the time for that comes. Similar textbook revisionist movements are gaining momentum in China and also in Taiwan, and really all of these movements seem to feed off of each other in a way. And these movements are all designed to fuel sentiments of nationalism among students. And if the hawkish leaders of these nations keep on winning the textbook wars, then the whole continent really might be primed for war. There's a similar trend underway in Russia regarding the legacy of Joseph Stalin. And what's happening there is that the Russian leadership under President Vladimir Putin is somewhat suddenly teaching about the history of Stalin in a way that really downplays all of the terrible aspects of Stalin's heinous rule. Back on January 25th of this year, Foreign Policy published a really powerful article explaining this trend. It's called For Putin, For Stalin. And this article does a great job of showing how the memory of Stalin is being kind of retrospectively sanitized in Russia. No longer is Stalin viewed as the tyrant who is responsible for the darkest chapter in Russian history. No longer is he seen as the man responsible for the torture and death of millions of his own people there under the Soviet system. The days of Russians remembering Stalin that way are coming to a rapid end. And now he's seen more and more as a heroic figure. He's seen as the man who defeated Nazi Germany. And of course, Stalin's USSR did play a big role in the Allied victory in World War II. But now that has become almost the only talking point that's permissible for Russians when they discuss Stalin. And that's really dangerous historic revisionism. But there's plenty of evidence to show that it is happening. I'll just read you a little bit from that Foreign Policy article. It says, in 2015, the Soviet dictator's resurrected cult of personality reached new heights. In May, Communist Party officials in Lipetsk erected a new Stalin bust. In July, the tiny village of Koroshevo opened a museum focused on his military exploits. And in December, Communist activists in the central Russian city of Penza opened a Stalin Center, the goal of which is to popularize and implement the practices that were in use during Stalin times and are still relevant today. Another major aspect of this happened in November of 2014 when President Putin said publicly that the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which cemented an alliance between Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin, was a good pact for Stalin to have made. You know, never mind the millions of Jews and Poles and others that were killed as a result of that agreement between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. Never mind all that. Putin says it was a good pact. And also under Putin's direction, history textbooks are being standardized to gloss over Stalin's barbaric crimes. The popular media is following Putin's lead in this sanitization effort of Joseph Stalin. And there's evidence showing that it really is working. In March of 2015, there was a poll taken showing that 45% of Russians believed that the sacrifices made by the Soviet people during the Stalin years were justified. That was up from only 25% 3 years earlier. And I think if a new poll were to be taken now, the figure would likely be well over the 50% mark, possibly even in the 60s. So it's easy to see that Putin really is presiding over the rehabilitation of one of the 20th century's greatest monsters, Joseph Stalin. And there's a very good reason why he's doing it. Putin is alarmed by the economic decay that Russia is experiencing, and he's fearful of dissent within Russia. He's afraid that the Russians will reach a breaking point and start to blame him for their suffering. So he's turned to the ghost of Stalin to help rally the Russian people and to make them more patriotic, to prepare them for the sacrifices that probably lie ahead. When you take this all together, you see that the message to the Russian people is clear. By revising history, Putin is saying, hey, just as Stalin did, I will take whatever steps I deem necessary to defend the country. And there may be collateral damage, but trust me, it's for the good of Russia. Putin is essentially saying, hey, just as your grandparents did in Stalin's time, you, modern Russians, need to do whatever I ask of you. And so far, the people seem to be entirely on board with this plan. So this new development in Russia and in Russia's teaching about Joseph Stalin really fits into the same pattern of what we discussed there in South Korea and Japan, and it's also happening in China. It's manipulating history in order to shape the worldview of the populace and to make the citizens more nationalistic. Well, we will have a short break, and after we're back, we'll get into a little bit about the United States and the United Kingdom and the way that they teach their students, also a distorted version of history, but one that is just the opposite of the whitewashing that we've been discussing. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG, 101.3 on the FM dial here in Edmond, Oklahoma, and the live stream is available at kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself.
The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Jeremiah Jacques standing in today for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Fleury. This is KPCG-FM. You can listen in online at kpcg.fm, or if you're in the Edmond, Oklahoma area, tune in at 101.3 on the FM dial. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments our way by emailing td@kpcg.fm. We'd love to hear from you. Well, in the first half of the show, we discussed the way many nations teach their students history in an imbalanced way that is designed to fill those students with patriotism and nationalism. And for the second half here, I would like to discuss how exactly the opposite trend is happening in some other nations, specifically the United States and Britain. In the book that I mentioned earlier, it's called History Lessons by Dana Lindemann and Kyle Ward, the authors wrote this about American history textbooks. Over the last 20 to 30 years, American textbook publishers have become averse to bold historical narratives for fear of being labeled as too conservative, too patriotic, or too sexist, and rendering themselves unattractive to buyers on the textbook market. In the first half, I mentioned how the United States claims not to have government meddling in its history textbook process. It claims to have a system for textbooks that is totally market-driven and completely decentralized. But a look below the surface shows that in many states, in the majority of states actually, legislators really do end up wielding significant control over the writing of history textbooks. And this is especially true in the quite liberal state of California. The Los Angeles Times published a scathing piece back in June of 2014 in which it called California the nation's capital of legislative interference with what should be the job of academics. This Times piece said California textbooks are subject to a long list of legislatively imposed rules for what our children should learn, whether the material is accurate and balanced or not. And it's also important to know that California has more public school students than any other state, and so it has massive buying power in the textbook market. And as a result of this, most textbook publishers in all of America end up tailoring their books sold to the whole country, specifically to the standards set by these California legislators. So a handful of legislators in California really end up imposing rules for what the textbooks can and cannot say. And these textbooks are used by many states in America. Not all of them, but a great number of them. And this California factor really explains why American textbooks have become averse to bold historical narratives for fear of being labeled as too patriotic, as Lindemann and Ward said there. California legislators are generally pretty firmly in the liberal camp, so patriotism and a love of America are usually revolting ideas to them. The prevailing view in the liberal camp is that America has always been an imperialist bully on the international stage. America has done great destruction with all of its meddling and interfering in the affairs of other nations. That's the narratives that many authorities in the liberal camp subscribe to, and the one that they work to foist onto others when they can. They want young Americans to learn to have contempt for America's past. So they teach history in an imbalanced way that emphasizes America's mistakes and then either omits or obscures America's accomplishments and the benevolence that the U.S. has had on the world stage, and the good that it's done for other countries. Those who are influencing how American students learn history seem to actively seek out any controversial actions that the country took. And the result is a group of textbooks that might as well be named The Terrible Things America Has Done. Or you could name one of these, the USA's History According to Pastor Jeremiah Wright, or something along those lines. I went through the United States public school system in the 1980s and 90s, and from my earliest years in history classes, the heavy emphasis was on the bad things that America did. We read great quantities about usurping of land from Native Americans, about witch hunts there in Salem, about the Wounded Knee Massacre, the Trail of Tears, President Roosevelt's theft of Panama from Colombia, America's bullying of Spain in the Spanish-American War, slavery, racism, segregation, lynch mobs, internment camps for Japanese Americans during World War II, the dropping of the atomic bombs on Japan and the terrible radioactive aftermath, the United States pillage of Vietnam, McCarthyism, and the list goes on and on. And of course, it is important. It's vital for Americans to study all of those things. It's vital for Americans to study the regrettable and the dark chapters from our past and the mistakes that we made. Of course, we should learn about things that our ancestors did wrong. How else could students learn from those mistakes and avoid repeating them? But shouldn't students learn the good with the bad? Shouldn't authorities strive to teach the past objectively? Instead, it really seems that vastly disproportionate weight is given to anything that can be made to support the narrative that America has always been kind of a bullying force. American history is manipulated in a way that really injects students with guilt and self-loathing and cynicism about the country. Back in 1956, world-renowned educator Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong said that he could, even at that early time, see that American students were starting to be taught to hate their nation. I'll read a quote from one of his booklets. It says, "We are fighting an entirely new kind of warfare. It's a kind of warfare we don't understand or know how to cope with. It uses every diabolical means to weaken us from within, perverting our morals, sabotaging our educational system, wrecking our social structure, destroying our spiritual and religious life, weakening our industrial and economic power, and demoralizing our armed forces." Pretty powerful words there. And 60 years on, it's easy to see that America's educational system has been compromised. And it has succeeded in turning many Americans against their country to varying degrees. You can order a copy of our free booklet, America Under Attack, to learn more about that sobering trend. And a parallel trend is underway in the United Kingdom. The British Empire was not perfect. It was administered by men, and all men ruled efficiently. But if the history of that empire were to be taught objectively, students would see that it was starkly different from all other empires that have come and gone over the ages. On the whole, it was a civilizing force that benefited mankind all around the globe. The British Empire brought the rule of law to people all over the world. It brought morality and education to the lands that it colonized. It didn't do it perfectly, but with all of these things, with the rule of law, morality, education, it lifted millions of people around the globe from squalor and from oppression. But you wouldn't really know much about the positive aspects of the British Empire if you just went through the public school system there in Great Britain today. Instead, just as in America, the focus overwhelmingly is on the problems with Great Britain's past. I've got a quote here from a Telegraph article from July 9th of 2013. It says, "British students learn only about the racism and oppression. These are important subjects, but they're not the whole story. By the time our national curriculum is finished with them, every school child in Britain has learned that their ancestors were bullies and egomaniacs. Instead of imparting an identity, the coursework will leave them with an identity complex. That will not make them confident citizens." So that's a pretty sobering assessment there from the Telegraph. And it just shows that in the United States and Britain, history is taught in a way that makes students ashamed of their nations and largely ignorant of the good that their countries did and just of how exceptional their countries really are and were. So it's just the opposite of the way history is taught in Japan and Russia and the other nations we discussed. There, they gloss over the atrocities in order to make students more patriotic. In the U.S. and the U.K., they gloss over the positive aspects, which leaves students cynical and scornful. Well, we should really be wary of a world that widely practices historical revisionism and that teaches history in a way that manipulates it and shapes populaces. We should be wary because this trend will have global ramifications. Perverting history hides its precious and vital truth. Manipulating it breeds ignorance. And historical ignorance prevents the world from learning from past mistakes. And that dooms us to repeat those mistakes, as the famous aphorism states. And then in the opposite direction, heaping undue scorn on what was a mostly positive history ends up hamstringing nations like the United States and the UK from being able to repeat past successes. Britain and America have long stabilized the world, but now their increasing self-loathing and guilt is causing that global stability to erode away. It's breaking it apart and leaving a void to be filled by nations that really would be bullies on the global stage to weaker countries. So really, this is about two converging trends. First is the deterioration of America's pride and Britain. And second is the resurgence of powers that have historically been aggressive. The Bible makes clear that these two converging trends will soon intersect, and that will lead to a time of trouble darker than any the world has ever endured. But the Bible also says that this darkness will break to the brightest dawn in all of history. That will be the return of Jesus Christ to usher in an age of truth and peace. The Bible itself records several millennia of really rich history, and it says that history is written for our admonition. That's what it says there in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 11. That Bible history is there for us to study and to learn vital truth from. This is the history that modern authorities hate most of all. They either ruthlessly attack it, just labeling it as myth, or even more often, they just do everything they can to ignore it. Men wish to be free of God, so they try to just erase him from the past, just as they work to oust him from the present. But so much of history is actually the record of God's plan to accomplish his purpose. Through the prophet Isaiah, God said, "Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure." That's in Isaiah 46, verses 9 through 10. And it really shows that God is not a passive observer of global events. He is working out his plan here below. At times, God even installs specific human rulers in positions of political power in order to accomplish his purpose. There's a passage in Daniel 4:17 that shows that. So history is vitally important. And we should all be asking ourselves that big question that I mentioned there at the beginning. What happened? And we should all be working to educate ourselves so that we can truly know what happened in history. Despite the flaws in the education we received from flawed man-made governments, we need to know what really happened. We need to educate ourselves in a way that corrects for those flaws and the imbalances that were inevitably in our education. I quoted Mr. Armstrong earlier, And he is the author of the single best book, I believe, that you can read in order to correct those flaws in your history education and to come to understand what happened and why it happened. The book is called The United States and Britain in Prophecy, and I hope you will contact us to order a free copy of it for yourself. It really will unlock vital truths about history that are unavailable anywhere else. The knowledge in this book will help you to start building a foundation of historical understanding that will enable you to avoid being deceived by national biases and national agendas. So please visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab there up at the top to order your free copy. It's absolutely free of charge. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG FM, 101.3 on the FM dial here in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available all around the world by typing kpcg.fm into your internet browser. And please send us your feedback, your questions, and your comments to our email address, td@kpcg.fm. Well, thank you for joining us today, and please tune in and join us again tomorrow when your regular host, Mr. Stephen Fleury, will be back.